We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we are looking at the Series 2 finale episode, Blake 7, by Chris Boucher, and it's called Star One. And maybe you can guess what this episode is about.
I have no idea. And I watched it.
Things are bad for the Federation, and they're getting worse. Computer control is breaking down on dozens of worlds, and there can only be one answer. Star One is failing. Servalan makes her move and declares martial law and herself president. But that doesn't alter the fact that no one knows the location of Star One. That is, other than Blake and Travis. And the technicians who elected to spend the rest of their lives on Star One performing maintenance. But something has gone wrong with them, and they are sabotaging the base. All except one technician, whom they are trying to kill. Star One is on a small planet orbiting a solitary white dwarf somewhere in intergalactic space between our galaxy and Andromeda. Beyond it, a massive minefield designed to keep something out. Arriving at Star One, Blake aims to destroy it, despite the chaos and death he'll be raining on innocents back in the Federation. He's captured and mistaken for Travis by the technicians. It is clear their plan is to let in a fleet of aliens to destroy the human race. Blake and Callie start to plant bombs to destroy Star One completely. The real Travis shows up and kills Blake stone cold dead, which no one saw coming. Travis starts to shut down the minefield, but then he's shot by Blake, who turns out wasn't killed at all, but was only resting. And of course, everyone saw that coming, because you can't have a show called Blake 7 without Blake. That would be mental. Travis was just resting too, but Avon kills him. Stone, cold, dead. For realsies this time, though. The minefield has been compromised, and the aliens are coming through. Back on the Liberator, Jenna decides to call Servalan and send the military. The only hope to repel the invasion now. Time is ticking on the bombs Blake planted, and now he's having second thoughts. He must save Star One to help repel the invasion, but he is too critically injured to do much other than prop up a wall. Avon and Callie heroically collect the bombs to be deposited on the surface. Star One is saved! Yay! Back aboard the Liberator now, Avon explains to the crew that he made a promise to Blake that they and the Liberator would hold back the invasion fleet until the Federation forces arrive. Blake comes to the bridge in a pointless gesture to tell Avon that he's always trusted him, and then he's sent packing back to the medical unit. The aliens are coming through. Fire! Calls out Avon. Roll credits. So, Blake 7, Star One, a whole year he has been looking for this base just so that he can blow it up, and now he has found it. What do you think?
It was okay.
It's all right. Yeah. It's all right.
Yeah. I think part of the problem, there's a lot of side drama that's taking place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mostly dealing with, you know, the technicians. Servalon's having this really great, you know, back at the Federation HQ, where she's at. She's having this great argument about how she can't do anything about Star One because she doesn't know where Star One is. You know, and then they did something really weird. She says, nobody knows where Star One is. Cut to Star One. And there are people on Star One. And I'm like, oh, well, I except for them. They know where Star One is, so I'm guessing it's a life sentence. Which it turns out it was.
It was, yes. It would have been even if they hadn't all been killed by the alien Andromedians and Andromeditians.
Yeah, and their ragtag fleet.
That is a heck of a ragtag fleet, isn't it? That is like every model that they've ever had on
every
Blake 7.
Scrap of a model.
And they've just put it out there and said, this is the fleet, because nobody builds fleets of ships all alike. That's just crazy.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I've always kind of enjoyed this episode.
Well, it's a good arc episode, but I think part of the problem is we've got this huge buildup. And along the way, even as we looked like we were really beginning to ramp up to approaching Star One, we've had these side episodes that just were like – felt like mm-hmm. filler until we could finally get to the last episode. And then it finally happens, and that's it. Tiny anticlimactic.
And they don't blow up Star One.
And they don't blow up Star One.
So all that work, which means everything Blake did was wasted, because he says that in the episode. He says, if I don't blow up Star One and I don't win, then everything I've done is for nothing. And all the killing and all the blood and all the violence has been entirely senseless. This is what I like about this episode. What I dislike about this episode and what I like about this episode are one and the same. One is that we actually now call Blake on this. Avon calls Blake on his. You can wade in blood up to your armpits and lead the rabble to victory. But Avon has – he tried in the last episode and he's at it again. Like, you are going to cause untold death and destruction by destroying Star One. You are not killing just Servalan and her forces. You are – and we see that. From even though it wasn't Blake doing it,
no, but we know.
But we see what kinds of things go wrong. The starship with 8,000 passengers killed, the city destroyed, planetary weather control destroying all their food production.
Yeah, the damage is going. I mean, there's so many innocent people that are going to be harmed by this action, and Blake has become so single-mindedly focused. I mean, this is. And we've talked about this a little bit. In the beginning, he really was more of the idealistic rebel hero, so to speak, that the anti-Federation citizens regarded him to be. And some ways, I think along the way, Blake began to kind of believe his own press and has become really more than just obsessed with achieving his ends, regardless of whatever damage he may create along the way. I mean, he's really turned into something of a rather ugly force of nature, and he's leaving disaster in his wake, if possible.
And Avon is the voice of
reason.
Not compassion, he's at least the voice of reason here.
Yeah, he's the voice of balance in this.
And there's a sequence. Okay. All right, let me slip just back. What I don't like about this episode is that we have seen little bits of this along the way, but it really gushes forth in this one. And I think the show would have been better had Blake built up a little more gradually to this single-minded obsession and the fact that the crew of the Liberator is willing to call him on what he's doing. So, I mean, that's where I kind of think if you look at Series 2, there's sort of this slow build and then a huge spurt just in episode Star One, and that's
right.
a little bit awkward. And then,
well, we first see it, it's more than just a little build up. You know, when we go back to the very first time where we had to say goodbye to Gan,
mm-hmm.
and there's that scene where Blake thinks he has found control,
right?
And he barges right in there, and he just arms raised in victory and laughing like a madman. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the first time, and we're really not seeing that gradual ramp up. It's like someone just hit a switch, and all of a sudden he's gone from being this rebel fighter to a maniac who has become sort of the antithesis, but just as equally intense as, you know, Servalan and or Travis. Take your pick, depending on the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He's become no better than they are.
And
it's really sudden. It starts there, and then it backs off.
That's the thing. I mean, we do see it there in that scene, and even that in Pressure Point,
right?
There's no build up to that.
None.
Just suddenly, I've found central control, and we're going to go destroy it. Whereas,
yeah, because we know that even in the beginning of that episode, he maintains, you know, there are people down there that I can trust. It's going to be safe. It's going to be good. Whatever, you know. And he manages to, in a very calm way, sweet talk, mm-hmm. you know, his crew to support him in this.
Right.
And he seems perfectly rational. There's not this crazed obsession. Right. And all of a sudden, boom, now he's a wild man.
And so let's talk a little Gareth Thomas in his portrayal as Blake. Blake takes a lot of stick, or Gareth Thomas takes a lot of stick. Now, I know that Gareth Thomas is an accomplished actor. He's Rada. He's got the chops, but there are days in Blake 7 when he is just completely phoning it in. And there are other days when he is on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really strange the way Blake is. You could be forgiven for saying that guy is a crap actor on some days, and on other days, he is there. He's not exactly on fire on this episode.
No.
And like, there's a scene where Callie asks him if all the killing is justified, and he says, I forgot exactly what he says, but I have to win. If I don't, winning is the only way I know that I was right. And I mean, he really like that I was right.
I mean, it's like wow, it's talk about ego at this point.
And Callie's like, I? And Blake, you know, walks off and then, but yeah, they really are cranking his ego up to 11, and you know, everyone else sees it. Everyone else. Jenna stops Avon on the way down to Star One, and she says, you know, look out, keep an eye on him, because he's going into this way too fast. And Blake says, well, he's not thinking.
Avon, idealist.
Avon, yeah. He's an idealist. He cannot afford to think.
But he's not behaving like an idealist at this point.
Yes, but I think Avon's got a point.
To some degree.
An idealist and an ideologue are about similar
yeah.
things. And, you know, I think we grant idealists a pass because we all think ideals are a good things. Are a good things? Is a good idea, because we put the word ideals has a positive connotation.
We consider ideals to be a virtue.
Right. But then you get to someone who is so steeped in their own dogma, whatever it happens to be.
I have an ideologue.
Yes, and they are not necessarily a good thing. And Blake is right there. He's got his ideals, but now they have become twisted towards winning at all costs.
Yes, absolutely.
And so that's why, no, he can't think. If he stopped to think, if Blake, the nice guy that we know that he actually is, stopped to think about this, he probably wouldn't do it. And we know that because at the end of the episode, suddenly he's like, oh, maybe I shouldn't blow up Star One. Because
no,
if you
right.
truly pass the path, then it's like, fine, let the aliens come in and blow up the Federation. And then,
you're absolutely right. And, you know, I don't want to go into a big sidecar discussion about philosophies or anything like that. But you are correct. I think a true idealist would be able to weigh all the options and possible consequences, you know, and be able to approach things with some sort of rationale. An ideologue is, as you said, someone who's so singularly focused on that particular ideal that if you start sacrificing other ideals, then your initial ideals are worthless at that point. And that's what's happened to Blake here.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's mm-hmm. so single-minded. I mean, if we were talking first season Blake, very, very early first season, he wouldn't have done this. I don't think he would have, from what we saw, he would not have done this because he knows the kind of damage that would have done to the innocent people.
I'm just gonna stop back and go Horizon. No, I'm not going to say Horizon. I'm going to say Mission to Destiny.
Hmm.
That's the point where Blake mines the spacecraft just to blow up the people coming in. I think so. There's always been a little bit of...
Is that his slippery slope?
I don't know if that's what started it, but I mean, I think that shows us that's a first glimmer of how Blake feels justified in his actions
to the point of
killing.
Yeah, it's when you see the crack on the wall.
Right. It's Blake's crack, which I do not want to see. Amy's crack, fine. Blake's crack, no. We do not want to see that.
I'm not making any jokes.
Don't go anywhere. It's right. It's anyway. So this is. I love the fact that Blake 7 is discussing this. I wish that it had gone on longer, and I think it's something that they could have done with a lot more, you know, the Liberator is not exactly the most harmonious crew in space anyway, so this could have been something that was more of a point of contention along the way that, that could have given them some dramatic work, and perhaps it will as time goes on, now that Blake has seen the error of his ways. But I feel cheated because it's just all here in Star One all of a sudden.
And we didn't see the gradual progression to this point. And that's part of the reason why I'm having such a hard time with this episode. I mean, it's okay, but there are just some story elements, and maybe not story elements, but just pieces and parts to this episode that just make me think, okay, by virtue of having to now throw this at us, I feel like I'm being distracted a little bit from your A plot. A little bit, because one of the nice things is the fact that there is enough self-awareness to where Blake is called out. And I did like that. I like that a great deal. I like it when television shows do that, when you can start to see the error. I mean, me, the viewer, mm-hmm. You know, when I'm watching a show and I see a character behaving that in a way that is just really like more than just inappropriate, and then all of a sudden somebody else comes along. And then that character voices what it is that I was thinking. I really appreciate that because there's a certain self-awareness on the part of the writer when crafting your story and crafting your characters to go in this particular direction or to take these particular actions. And you got this one other person who's the voice of reason or the voice of rationality and says, wait a minute, do you realize what you're doing?
Hmm.
You know, but there's so many other TV shows that will not do that, and they will just assume that us viewers are just, you know, stupid geeks who are, you know, forever drooling at the mouth, staring at Princess Leia wearing slave outfits.
Remember that episodic – Blake 7, we're still talking about Blake 7, which is one of the earliest precursors to – story arc.
Absolutely.
And the Star One is probably
it's the first cliffhanger.
The strongest one that we've got possibly throughout all of Blake 7, but you know, we've got a couple more years to talk about, but the Star One arc is really the first one where, so this is uncharted territory, but
right.
But one of the reasons you don't get it in non story arc episodes is because you have to reset everything at
Absolutely.
The end of the episode.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why a single standalone film can be a superior emotional experience, a lot of times...
Oh, you have length.
A film has what they call a three-act restorative narrative. The first act is introducing you to the character and basically ends with the dilemma, if you will. And then the second act of the hero is taken away from the audience. The audience sees what he's doing wrong, and he's taken the wrong path. So here you are in the audience going, no, you idiot, go with that girl. Go with the plain one who's obviously so much better for you. And then they follow him down that path further and further away from the audience until you get to the end of that second portion where you have the major crisis cliffhanger, and then you essentially use the third act to bring him finally back into alignment with what the audience thinks. But by the time you're done with that, he is a changed person.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot start the next movie without him being a different character.
True.
And so, you know, difference between drama and melodrama, perhaps. You know, Indiana Jones really doesn't make much difference from the end of the film or from the beginning of the film to the end of the film because he's not traveling that. But
no, he's not on a Jerry
Maguire arc. You know, there's a classic example of that film. He's going down the path and he was like, no, that's not what you should have done. You should have gone with the girl with the kid with the buggy eyes. And in the end, everything works out happy for him. But really, that adventure is done and his life goes off and does something completely
different. No, you're right. You're right. And yes, I admit I'm being a little unfair. I am spoiled with some of the science fiction stories and movies and even the books that I read, how I see more of some kind of emotional arc that our characters go on. And yes, in a perfect world, what I would have liked to have seen are for our characters to, you know, on the arc related episodes for the season, have them go on their emotional arc. And then the moment you're presented with an episode that is non-arc related, by the time they hit their reset and they go back to the emotional arc, you know, that they pick up where they left off on that emotional journey. Yes, Blake 7 didn't quite do that. They didn't fully understand what they were doing, not to the kind of degree that we've got with television shows today.
Which are very self-conscious about it, which yes. Is too much so. But that's another argument for Bad Wolf Day.
no comment.
But anyway.
But yeah, I admit that I am being in some sort of really weird, you know, looking backwards kind of way, I am judging the show just a little bit too harshly. I know that when I came into this series, I already came in with somewhat lower expectations, and I do that with Doctor Who a lot, especially when I'm watching older Doctor Who. You know, there are every once in a while there is an old episode out there that I haven't seen before, and I always go in with very, very low expectations because I understand, well, this is late 1960s or early 1970s. So yeah, you know, obviously they're not quite as polished as the later episodes are. And I know that I approach Blake 7 with that sort of thinking, but there was just something about this whole Star One arc and Blake's journey that was very disjointed, and it was distracting.
Yeah, it is. You know, side thing, but this is kind of an interesting thought. You said we're looking at 1960s, 1970s television, you have lower expectations. And in a way, I understand that completely, because if you just look at the special effects, for example, or you look at the way they do the sets, or the way the cameras can work, or the way that they have to record the episode, you have lower expectations. But I can't help thinking that old Billy Shakespeare, 500 years ago, put together some of the most astoundingly well thought out and crafted writing.
Ahead of his time.
Well, it's not just that. It's that it proves that writing itself, there's no excuse for cruddy writing.
No, I agree.
You can't. A 1967 show should be just as well written as a 2015 show.
You're
but
right.
The execution is what you have to forgive.
That's the point that I was about to make, and you are correct. When I say lower expectations, I'm not saying that I'm now all of a sudden giving a bunch of hand waves to really, really bad writing. As we have said a number of times now, this is really the first serious attempt, especially, you know, clearly in science fiction, mm-hmm. at creating a story arc. It had not been done before, not to this degree. So it was a learning process for them.
Yeah.
Now, granted, there are some stories that, and we've discussed them, there are some that are just kind of weak. We've had some Blake 7 episodes that just didn't really stand up very well. And on the other hand, we've had some others that were quite superior. So, you know, and I'll take that, you know, that's so many other shows are like that. I mean, heck, Star Trek, one of our favorite TV shows, you know, they had great episodes. They had poor episodes. It's just a natural, part of life.
It's part of the process of making a TV show. It's compromises.
Exactly. But the manner in which they were constructing the story arc, that's where I feel like I might be a little bit harsh, that maybe I'm being just a little bit too unfair, because I'm so used to seeing like what Straczynski did with Babylon 5,
right?
For example. Right. So when I look back at Blake 7,
truly still is the finest example of that. I cannot think of any other show that has achieved that level of, wow, 27 episodes ago, they told me about this in passing in the back of a newspaper.
And there it is.
Yeah, that is still astounds me with Babylon 5. And if there's anything, you know, ever to give kudos for J. Michael Straczynski for nothing else, staggering achievement in that respect.
Right. And he's had
– does other stuff. But,
yeah. I mean, he's had but so when you look back at Blake 7 – I don't know if this is exactly what Terry Nation had in mind. I mean, I think he had some kind of an idea about creating some sort of a space opera for that time.
I think this is Chris Boucher, yeah.
Or more Chris. Well, I'm talking about the creation of the series.
Hmm.
The series in general.
I don't know. I don't know. I'm reading the biography of Terry Nation, but I haven't gotten that far into it. But yeah, maybe I'll have some insight before I'm done with before we're done with Blake 7 on that. I don't know. I really don't. I get the feeling that Terry Nation. Well, I know that Terry Nation was asked to make some pitches, and he didn't have a plan when he started. He pitched Dirty Dozen in Space, and they said, "Oh, like that, do it." And
so maybe they were approaching it as just a series of episodic misadventures.
And Terry, you know, it really was a collaborative effort between him and Chris Boucher after they got going. But Terry Nation does get a lot of the credit for it. I don't know. Here, you know, speaking of character development. Okay, I've got one here, a note, and this is kind of interesting. We have talked about this before. We'll bring it up again. I cannot stand episodes of TV shows or movies or whatever it happens to be where the villain is just bonkers, barking, insane, and he has a plan to destroy everything. I can't stand that. But, and usually it's because it's very hard to get into the mind of the mad character and say, yeah, right, I can see why he wanted to do that. In Travis's case, I kind of can. Travis has taken quite the journey from that military guy that barged in on Servalan on day one in Seek, Locate, and Destroy. That, you know, you obviously don't want me to wait out there, Commander. That is an incredibly bold, confident military officer who, despite the change in character in actors, which has had probably had an accelerating effect on this, his downfall was working its way through the first series to the point where at the end of series one, you know, he was quite subservient to Servalan. She had broken him.
Oh, yeah.
And now that breaking has gone further. And so by the time he does get to this, even though it doesn't make any sense, when last episode he's talking about, I could take over the universe with Star One, and in this episode he's kind of like, I can kill them all, and it's only a shame they won't know who did it. But I can kind of see it, because he has been breaking down the whole time. He has been getting worse and worse throughout the entire series till we reach the point here where he's been dead and thrown down the nuclear reactor in the middle of the Death Star. Or whatever it was that they chucked him down there at the on Star One. So I don't like it, because he's just basically doing the whole I'm just causing destruction for destruction's sake. But it's as close as I can recall in a show where I could sort of go, all right, yeah. If you're doing James Bond films and you've got Drax wanting to wipe out all the human beings, but at least he's, you know, got a space station full of bodacious babes ready to repopulate the planet. And if you're Stromberg in The Spy Who Loved Me, yes, you're going to cause a nuclear war and destroy everything. But hey, you can build a world under the sea, and you've got the resources and the money to
do it. You see the method to the madness.
Yes, it's not quite bonkers. But when the Time Lords want to come through from Gallifrey and wipe out all of time, or Davros wants to destroy all reality, you think, why? This doesn't, I can't do it. And in Travis's case, this is pure revenge on Servalan and all the people who have made his life a misery. And
doesn't that make him the opposite side of the same coin that is
as
Blake?
Yes, it does. It absolutely does. The two of them have been following different trajectories to Star One the whole way, and they're both...
Now they're mirrors of each other, almost.
They want to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Travis wants to basically do the same thing that Blake does.
And virtually for the same reason, to wreak havoc on the Federation and Servalan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's
a fascinating character study when you look at the two of them together.
Mm-hmm. They're bookends.
Right.
Yeah.
Then it becomes very interesting. And that does cause – you know, we've discussed this before. I remember we've talked about this in the past about how Blake and that wacky Travis are just on this very interesting little parallel track almost.
Mm-hmm.
And neither one of them is would even have the open-mindedness to even entertain the fact that, you know, every time Blake is looking at Travis or vice versa, that each one is looking at a mirror of himself. And that's – there again lies in your whole ideologue.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you've got blinders on and you just cannot see reality for what it really is.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a fascinating study when you got the two of them together.
I think the biggest problem in this episode with Travis is that I cannot believe that Travis didn't pump a few more bullets into Blake. All that time that he spent and all he wants is to kill Blake. Blake comes in, he shoots him, apparently dead.
He doesn't even bother
to go over there and kick him a little bit to see if he's actually dead.
Or incinerate him, you know,
right.
Do something just out of pure vengeance.
So what do you think about the fact that it is actually Avon who kills Travis?
Didn't see that one coming, gotta admit. And I'm not sure if I found that satisfying or not. I don't think Blake wouldn't have done it unless he absolutely had unless his hand was forced. And that's the only difference between him and Travis. Travis would have happily killed Blake. Blake would have happily not killed Travis because Blake's crazy. Avon, on the other hand, because it's pragmatic, it's practical.
Mm-hmm.
Travis is a nuisance. He's more than a nuisance. He's a dangerous nuisance. So he needs to be eliminated if I want to achieve my goals of living a really rich and happy life. So yeah, Travis has to go.
All right, let's switch gears. Star One, out in intergalactic space. I suppose that's actually a clever idea. You have really no good way to navigate. You go out there, unless you don't know where that thing is, you're not going to find it. Nobody travels out there. Obviously, the crew of the Liberator are uncomfortable with leaving the galactic space and moving into intergalactic space. Callie calls it infinity.
That's way the heck out there.
So, given... what kind of idiot – well, there's two kinds of idiots. I'll start with the first kind of idiot. What kind of idiot, A, puts all their eggs in one basket and then makes everyone forget where the basket is? I mean, that's one. And we've talked about that before. That is the dumbest thing about Star One is – or it would be the dumbest thing about Star – it's the dumbest thing up until the beginning of this episode about Star One that we can't – nobody knows where it is. And in fact, in this episode, they are torturing people just to make sure that they didn't accidentally let some of the people who went to Star One have any free will when it comes to destroying Star One.
Yeah, Servalon goes on this whole big thing about the conditioning that they received, and yet, a lot of good that did.
Well, it did. They were killed. The people, they were killed and replaced
True.
By aliens.
Yeah, they're replaced by zombies.
And it's the girl, Lorena, who is even still constrained by it. She can't help Avon find anything in the place, despite the fact that she wants to. So, yeah, all right, it worked. But, you know, again, how on earth could you think it was a good idea to make everyone forget everything out there? And the only thing that makes that worse than that as the dumbest idea ever is, oh. Wait, you've placed it as the control center for a minefield, which obviously built in a direct line between our galaxy and Andromeda, and that minefield and early detection field is our defense. So do they not know the minefield's out there too? Did they forget about the minefield? And if they didn't, where do they think that minefield is?
I don't know. The whole premise of Star One is flimsy to begin with.
And would you put your most secure military installation along the invasion path from Andromeda?
Mm-mm.
No, that's what makes Star One even worse. It's just like, this is not your finest planning hour.
No. Now, it could, okay, this is 1970s, and if we're going to be using some kind of computer/security sort of analogy, I mean, even back – well, I don't know who they had – who Chris Boucher or anybody who worked for Blake 7 had to talk to about this. But I think today, with computers being so widespreadly used, as they are in mainstream society today. I mean, we look at that and, you know, we have a really good understanding about how you create all sorts of secure redundancies and things along those lines. And,
yeah, that's on Star 2.
Yeah.
The hot site is on Star 2. Yeah,
okay.
Everybody knows where that is.
Yeah,
though,
so everybody knows where that's, yeah, because we need to maintain it. Okay, yeah, my point, right there it is, exactly. And instead, yeah, as you're right, everything is all holed up at Star 1. And, man, that's an all-or-nothing deal. I mean, okay, yeah, you go through all this effort to try to protect it and to protect the Federation from outside invasion. But, man, all it takes is for one thing to really go wrong. And you're screwed. And we even see that.
Yep.
I mean, the one guy is, you know, he's talking to Servalyn. He says, it's got to be Star 1. She's like, no, it can't be.
Unthinkable.
Think of something else. He says, there isn't anything else. Well, there better be something else because it can't be Star 1. You know, and even there, you get the sense of it's part denial, part panic. Because she realizes, holy crud, if really is Star 1, we're sunk.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, she's there threatening to the point of basically killing her aide or her computer expert if he doesn't come up with a better plan.
Yeah, that's really going to help.
That's going to help. I think they're, you know, futilely lashing out like a child. It says, you better come up with something. And, you know, there's nothing that they can do. Yeah, Star 1. So, but I'm going to give you this opportunity. Although I admit I cheated a little bit and took a look and I didn't pull up some numbers, but I'm going to give you this so that you can do this for next time.
Mm-hmm.
We know Earth, right? We understand where Earth is. We
relatively
know
in the galactic spiral, yeah.
People have that information. You could go to NASA and figure out what our distances are to the edge of the galaxy, yeah. et cetera. And we know where Andromeda is.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So... And we know how long it takes the fleet to get to Star 1.
Yeah.
You might be able to do some extrapolation and come up with, but I'm seeing it as something on the order of they must be traveling several thousand times the speed of light.
They would have to be.
I think. I haven't done the numbers yet, but because, unfortunately, Andromeda does not lie out the spiral arm. It lies up and to the other side of the Milky Way from us. So
yeah, it's going to take quite a – although, I mean, hey.
We don't know where the ships are coming from, but we can assume that a lot of the fleet is somewhere in the, you know, Earth-ish area of space.
What is the year for Blake 7 again?
I think it's 800 years in the future.
Okay, even 800 years in the future – the rotation of the Milky Way would still
not
put Earth in a direct, you know, virtually line of sight to Andromeda. Right.
But we know that in a direct line of sight from where they exited the galaxy, so the nearest point from Andromeda to our galaxy, we could figure out where that is in a straight line.
Yeah.
And that's where Star 1 is.
It would have to be.
They said it was. It was in a direct line between the nearest point between the two galaxies. So it's really kind of like up on the hat of the sombrero and off 45 degrees in the distance kind of thing. But and then it's the other side of the sombrero from where we are. But anyway, it's something. If you had nothing better to do, you could try to poke around and see if maybe there's some way you could come up with even remote guess at how fast they're traveling, but they get ships there in 2 to 4 hours.
Yeah, I know.
It sounds like most of the fleet will be there within 4 to 6 hours.
Yeah.
When they're giving a thing. You know, some of them are near Earth.
It's one of the things that I mean, I didn't bother to write it down because I didn't actually think we were going to discuss it, but it's one of the things that as I was watching, I thought, this is just not feasible in the slightest.
And we kind of know what time distort – we know their maximum time distort speeds.
Isn't it 12?
So I think 12 was as high as they could go, and that was their experimental ships. And so pursuit ships. So, yeah, we could work out that the fleet's probably running around time distort 8 to 10. So, yeah, with some pursuit ships ahead of the game, they can be there quicker. So, yeah, a little bit of work. I suspect that we could come up with an incredibly improbable figure.
Yeah, I'm sure we could.
The ship was going, so Let's see. Callie uses telepathy for good. It's a trap, Avon.
Yeah.
Yay, she remembered she's a telepath again.
Yeah, I really like it whenever that happens. And I wish they would use it more often, but then I could see, you know, and I hate to say this, but I could see how it could turn into a crutch, especially for the writers.
On the other hand.
But if you keep her on the ship all the time, what good is, you know, her telepathy is not going to help her at all.
It's a trap, Avon. Two technicians have captured us. They are taking us into the base. They think Blake is Travis. They think we're going to do something nasty to the thing. Are you listening, Avon? I'm still transmitting.
Yeah.
They didn't really take it far as it might have been. But anyway, yeah,
At least she used it. Yeah, but you're right. I was a little surprised by that. And I always keep coming back to, why the heck don't they use that more often? And you know, going back to an older Blake 7 episode where Callie warns Blake on something and says, you know, you should do that more often.
Mm-hmm. Well, same reason. Why didn't they just have Orak shut down all the computers?
Oh, good Star One. God, don't get us started on that one again.
Orak should be able to do everything Star One does by himself.
Yeah, Orak should have been able to shut down Star One without them even heading out there.
Yeah. So,
because obviously Star One is sending signals to remote control satellites and planetary weather systems, and Orak, being the way he was designed, should have been able to intercept them and do whatever nefarious things Blake needed him to do to bring down the Federation and end the series much sooner than
and
it
wade
would.
In blood.
And wade up to your armpits in blood, yeah.
Blood. So I is Chris Boucher, and my understanding from background reading is that Chris Boucher is probably the one that is responsible for a lot of the dialogue that is known for Blake 7, the snarky,
the witty repartee.
The witty repartee. And this one was loaded with it. I really thought Avon was on top form in this episode. But I particularly liked where Travis is saying, I thought you were the ones with brains, Avon. And Avon's response is, brains but no heart. Now talk or scream. It's like he is laying on with a trowel.
Yeah, that's pure Avon. Is it any wonder why he became the singularly most popular character in the show?
Right. He's eclipsing Blake.
Not good. Yeah. Not if it's a Blake 7 show.
Right, right.
I mean, because next thing
you know, but remember JR. Remember JR in Dallas.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, that sometimes the
second banana gets the bigger light, yeah.
Well, and he's meant to be kind of a foil, but the fact is that everybody kind of wishes you could be that way from time to time. You know, Avon's not intrinsically evil. Yes, he's killed people.
Yeah, but he's not an evil man. Not like Travis.
Or Blake. Oof. By the end of this thing.
Yeah.
You know? So, it's, yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed this one, and that it's a good episode for just sort of, you know, having the talks and reminding us why we love Blake 7.
And I think that's really one of the characteristics about the series that a lot of people walk away from. It's the lines. Because that... Mm-hmm. Those lines tell us who these characters are. And Avon and Villa have the best lines, especially when they are dialoguing back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably why they are among the most memorable of characters, because they had the best lines. And by, you know, and now you come into this interesting area of characterization. What comes first? The character? Does the character form the line, or does the line form the character?
Maybe a little of both.
I'm wondering if it's just not a bit of both, depending on the circumstances.
I think it's both. You know, they start feeding the lines, and then I think the lines create the character, and then the character inspires them to do the lines.
And it goes back and forth.
Back and forth and keep it up. So one last thing here. So we've got Avon's journey in this episode, too, although... And I suppose you could say he's had a journey along the way from the beginning of the story. He has rescued Blake. He has rescued the others. He has had the opportunity to leave and not leave. He's had opportunities to leave where he forsakes that just to save the others. He seems to be anti-Blake, but I almost wonder if he is just acting as Blake's conscience, almost, which is funny, considering that he is considered the amoral character of the bridge. But there is a scene towards the beginning of the episode where Aven is talking to Blake about destroying it, but he wants to be done. I want it over. I want this finished. I want to be free. And Callie's like, well, you are free. No, I want to be free
of him.
Pointing at Blake. And Blake turns to him and says, you really do hate me,
don't you?
And Aven does not answer that
question.
No, he doesn't. But I don't...
Because I don't think Avon does hate him.
No, I don't. He couldn't possibly hate him, or he would have just simply killed him and got rid of him.
Oh, absolutely.
But I think he hates what Blake has become.
Uh-huh. And what Blake has got them doing as a result of what he has become.
Right. And he wants the Liberator, and of course everyone on the ship's all like, whoa, wait a minute now. It's like, but, you know, you guys are all beta and gamma and delta dogs on this ship. Blake and Aven are the only two that have the slightest claim to alpha dog
right.
on the ship. And so then we turn that around at the end. Why are we doing this, Aven? Why are we going to stand here against an invading fleet and try to hold them off for at least an hour?
Because I promised him.
Because I promised Blake I'd do it. And Villa's like, this is stupid. And Avon's like, when did that ever stop us?
Yeah, but to be fair, I think even Aven realizes that if
they're
this
dead.
But more than that, I think he realizes, and at least I would, that if I were the kind of person like Aven is, I have to realize that in order to have the kind of lifestyle that I so richly desire, I can't have this invading force coming just barreling right through and mucking it all up.
That's true too. That's true. We could attribute this instead of I promised him to, you know, we have no future. And he could have answered it that way.
Yeah, but I think
he doesn't answer
it that way.
He answers it, I promise.
Well, I think the only reason he agreed to promise Blake is because he realizes it was in his own self-interests as well.
Which answer would play more realistic to the crew of the Liberator?
That he promised Blake.
See, I think that they would expect him to reason it out and say, for the same reason reason that Jenna decided we have to call Servalan. For the same reason that Blake decided we have to call Servalan and not destroy Star One. Everyone there has realized that there is an absolute need for Star One to continue to exist and for the fleet to get there and to stop this invading alien fleet. And so all Aven had to do was say, you know, we have to hold them back or we are all dead or everyone's dead. But instead he says, I promised Blake. And that's weird, but it doesn't feel out of place.
No.
And then when Blake comes up to the bridge, Aven is all...
Oh, you didn't trust
me? ...dimped up and it's like, yeah, what, don't you trust me to do this? And Blake is like, well, for what it's worth, I have always trusted you since the very beginning. I don't know that that's true. I think maybe it is, because I don't think he would have done some of the things he did if he didn't trust Aven.
Yeah.
Like leave him aboard the ship, etc. But it's interesting that Aven has to ask him that question. What, didn't you trust me? I think Aven trusts Blake, but does not believe that Blake trusts him.
Hmm.
I think that is the nature of Aven.
Well, perhaps
he doesn't think anybody trusts him. You know,
it's true. Although I was going to say, I don't know if it's so much a case of Aven trusting Blake, but more Aven trusting Blake to behave in a certain way, to follow a certain path of behavior and action based on characteristics. And based on that knowledge, Aven could then decide where his trust falls. Does he trust the person or not?
But the other thing you could say is with his line about, I promised, that is also, we can read that as friendship. I'm doing that for a friend. I'm doing that for
Yeah,
someone that's
and we have seen
close to me. I mean, close in the
I think they're
completely ordinary male bonding way.
I think they're. Yeah, I think you're right. I think there is, although I don't believe Avon would ever dare to admit it. At least not at this stage of the show. I mean, maybe by the time we get to the end of the series, perhaps.
Definitely,
Avon and Blake might actually be able to talk to each, you know, look each other eye to eye, and be able to be able to fess things
work
up,
work out their differences. Yes,
yeah, with any luck.
Yeah, I think we've got it. We've run to a new plateau of the Blake Avon dynamic, and
I would say that there
it will be interesting to see where that goes.
I would say that there is
How far would Avon go for Blake? I think that's an interesting question that we might be looking at in later episodes.
Oh, absolutely.
Of the series. I don't know that I have anything else.
No, not in terms of the heart of this entire episode. I mean, everything else, I mean, is just like little trivial. Oh, I saw this other thing, you know, here, and just little nonsensical things, you know, production gaffes,
mm-hmm.
things like that. I mean, there's just one scene that I had to keep playing back because it made me laugh, and they're on the planet and soldiers are running up a hill, and you look in the background, you see a small English village.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Things like that.
The power lines
back
there. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, I went, okay, well, it is the BBC. I don't care if it is a theater division. It's still BBC.
Yeah, they can definitely digitally comp that out now.
Today they can,
When they redo Blake 7 and replace the two-dimensional animated
with CGI.
With flash animation.
The flash animation. Oh, God.
Well, that would be the thing to do. So instead of that picture of the sliding the piece of paper with a liberator on it.
I know. That really is just god-awful. Especially when you compare it against some... Every once in a while, there is a really, really awesome model shot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. The Liberator is cool ship.
It's an awesome ship.
But unfortunately, sometimes it's made of paper.
Yeah,
and it's flat.
I feel like I'm watching, you know, my Monty Python animation.
Yeah, it
is. Oh, Terry Gilliam, he did this. How nice.
He did. All right. Well, then I guess we're ready to plunge on into series 3.
Wow.
Of Blake 7. Wow. We are halfway through. And people, Blake 7 is exactly 13 episodes per series for 4 series. So if you're at the end of series 2, you're exactly halfway through. Yay!
That's right.
We've made it.
To the halfway point.
And we plan to keep going, but at 1 every 4 episodes, that's about two more years. About 2 more years to come to the end of Blake 7.
Oh my God, has it been that long?
Well, let's see. We roughly run these things every 4 weeks. Right, a Blake 7, so you got a Blake 7, then we have another show that you and I are doing, and then one or two that Simon and I are doing. So, yeah, every 3 to 4 weeks. Blake 7, if you ran 4 years, 13 times 4 is 52 episodes. That's one per week if we did one per week. So every 2 weeks, 2 years for the whole series. Every 4 weeks, 4 years for the whole series. So, yeah. Yeah, maybe a marathon somewhere. Maybe a binge podcast.
Oh, my God.
At some point in the middle. But series... 3.
Wow.
I am looking forward to it. This is, you know, keep going. Anyway, taking a moment here, because I'm going to take a moment here for quite a while to remind listeners that we are potentially a listener-supported podcast, and we would love for you to help us out and keep Fusion Patrol going long enough to last through Blake 7 and some of those other awesome shows, Space 1999, for example, that we're currently working on. And to do that, you can find us at patreon.com/fusionpatrol, where for as little as, I think, $1 an episode, you could help us out and keep the show going. So please consider it. Ben.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Or me. Or us. Me and my tea mug. Here, thank you for joining me and my tea mug here today.
Thunk.
Yeah, I heard the mug, didn't you?
Yeah.
See, I actually have a tea mug here that I have been secretly turning the microphone off and having a sip out to go. But
no, I've got a screwdriver, and I'm not talking the tool. I'm talking the drink. It's right next to me.
Yeah. Do they have a sonic version of that?
Let me get back to you on that.
You know, that is an interesting question. I mean, they make Pangalactic Gargle Blasters. Does anybody make a sonic screwdriver as an alcoholic beverage? Probably at conventions.
Probably.
You know, something else.
Yeah. I've never really gone to any of the drinking panels, so I can't say.
Well, listeners, thank you. And we hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Confirmed.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Leave us a review on iTunes or stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fusionpatrol. Our Twitter username is @fusionpatrol, or you can just send us a comment at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Come check out our new YouTube channel at youtube.com/fusionpatrol. Please, come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.